Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And this hour coming up, we have a very special treat. We're going to listen back to a selection from deep down in the Steiner Show archives. Every week, we'll be trying to bring you some new things from some of the great interviews of the past. And this one, 17 years ago, I interviewed the great singer and actress Eartha Kitt. It's all coming up now just for you. Enjoy.
Yesterday it seemed the world was about to end. Didn't it look as though it wouldn't last out the year? Yesterday disaster waited around the bend. Well, my friend, spring is here, back in business, and ain't it grand? Let the good times roll. Yesterday things were out of hand.
That, of course, is Eartha Kitt. And here is Eartha Kitt. Welcome to our studios. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
For gracing our
studios. On a
dreary
day like this.
We've just brightened up the dreary day.
But, you know, I never think of weather as being dreary. It's just a different kind of climate.
Right.
And therefore, you take what the gods are sending you and be
all weather
happy
is
about
good.
It. Yes, everything is good.
That song we just heard, I'm really glad. Thank you for being here. It's lovely to have you in our studio. And I think all of Baltimore has just been waiting as soon as they heard Eartha's going to be on the show. I'm sure everybody's just tuning in and waiting now. the song that we just heard, that was a time when you came back to America in some senses, wasn't it? For mm-hmm. that long period that you had from 1968 almost to the 90s, where you had a very difficult time because of your outspokenness in 1968.
Yes, well, I was put out of work in America because Johnson decided he didn't want to see my face anywhere because I was against our involvement in Vietnam. But according to the way the story was presented to the media, I don't blame the media because they get the story and they run with it. That's their business to do that. But Johnson sent out across the nation and that he didn't want to see my face anywhere. So he told the event according to the way he wanted me to be presented in the eyes of the American public, to deface me, make me feel like a negative, make the public think that I'm a negative person, and therefore nobody ever really heard the real story. I was not there to sing songs. I was there to give my opinions, along with 49 other women, about our involvement in Vietnam at the time. And the stories that our young boys had told me from various areas of this country and all over Europe, whenever they could get into my dressing rooms and my hotel rooms, we'd all sit on the floor, and these boys who had fled the United States because they didn't want to be involved in Vietnam would tell me what they felt. When I came back to America, I looked up some of the mothers of these boys, and they felt the same way, and I felt the same way. But it was Mrs. Johnson's time for beautifying America.
Lady Bird.
Lady Bird, John. Beautifying America and putting $2 billion worth of seeds along Route 66. And I thought, what's the problem with this picture?
And you told her so.
Yes, because she asked me to give my opinions. And therefore, within 2 hours, according to what I read, I was out of work.
You had club dates canceled.
Everything was canceled. Even the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, where Bobby Kennedy was shot, you know. I had a 3 weeks engagement there about 2 or 3 weeks after that luncheon, and they couldn't find the contract. Agents didn't want to be involved with me because they said, "We love your work, Eartha, but you're a CIA FBI problem." You know, and when the president comes down on you, you say, "My God, now what's wrong with this picture, for instance? My mother gave me away, and now my government is giving me away. Something is wrong here."
It was...
And because they asked me my opinion. If they didn't want to know the truth, why would they ask me? Because they knew what I was all about even before I went to that luncheon.
It's amazing. With the Freedom of Information Act, it was found out that CIA actually had memos on you to keep you out of work.
Right. And they'd said absolutely nothing. It is rumored that she is a sex nymphomaniac. Sadistic on top of all of that. And I said, what the devil does the government have to do with my sex life? They're wasting your tax money to find out what kind of sex life I have? Something is wrong here, too. Not only that, they sent out the FBI, Mark. The FBI couldn't find anything on me. I happen to be a very clean, good American citizen. I happen to love this country. And if I didn't love this country, I would have stayed in one of those European countries where I was already a star before I came back to America. But I want to be home in my own country because basically this country stands for wonderful, wonderful things. And in this country, if something is not quite kosher, you can always fight for what you know is the right thing to do. Freedom of speech. So in this case, I didn't have the freedom of speech. They took it right off my tongue. But the FBI goes out and they tried to find something on me. They couldn't find anything. And they came back and said, we can't find anything on her. This was also on one of the dossiers. She happens to be a good, clean American citizen. She hasn't even been arrested for anything. So they started making up stories because now that's good news. They're not going to take that, President Johnson, that is. So he sends the CIA out after me. And that's when these horrendous stories come back. Rumors.
And you were a major star, and still are, in Europe. I mean, in the 40s, and then again in the 60s and 70s.
No, I became a star in Europe in 1950, yes.
You danced I'm sorry.
I went over there with the Katharine Dunham Ballet Company about 1947, and I was put into a nightclub there in 1950, and that's where Orson Welles saw me in the club and cast me opposite him in his production of Faust as Helen of Troy. Now, Helen of Troy, as you know, is the woman that was supposed to be the most beautiful, the most everything in the world. So, here
I am. So you were typecast.
Yes. So, it's about the students going into the museums and they're doing their history. And the statue of Mephistopheles and Faust comes to life in the feeling of this girl who becomes Helen of Troy, one of the students. It's Orson Welles' interpretation, of course. He took from Marlowe and Goethe and even Shakespeare, mm-hmm. I think. So anyway, comes the scene. Well, they are talking to each other about whatever they're talking about. And
this is on stage, by the way.
This is on stage, right? Yes. And he said, I thought you thought that Helen was the most beautiful woman in the world. And Faust puts his hands out, which is Orson Welles, of course. And he says, Helen, come, make me immortal with a kiss. So the student gets up and she crawls over to Orson Welles. She sits in his lap. Now the audience is he's facing the audience. When I sit on his lap, my back is to the audience. So he takes me in his arms. Helen, make me immortal with a kiss. And he kisses me. But crunch, right into my bottom lip, and the blood started squirting everywhere. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't move because Orson is holding me so tight. And when the curtain comes down, I have just enough time to run off stage, get an apron, and come back, and now I'm a modern Mary Doe. And I have to sing a little song called Hungry Little Trouble, Damned in a Bubble, while the blood is running down my cheek and my mouth is swelling up. And I'm taking this little apron and wiping my mouth
on stage.
On stage. It was really hysterical. And when I went to him after the show was over, and I was beating him on the chest, you know, and said, Orson, why did you bite me? He said, I got excited. But I had a wonderful time working with that guy. It was crazy, but it was wonderful.
What must that have been like for you then, a very young woman, dancing with this great company in Europe, being seen by one of the great theatrical minds of all time, Orson Welles, who wants to snatch you up, called you one of the greatest women that ever lived, and to work with that? For a woman at that point in Europe like that, must have been an awfully interesting experience.
Well, Mark, I can say it was pretty scary, to tell you the truth. It was frightening, because there was a time when I was doing my words as Helen of Troy in front of Orson, when he got mad at me because the audience was behaving to me like he wanted the audience to behave
him.
With him, yes. And he would stand in front of me. So when I had my words to say, it looked as though Orson Welles was with us. He was really hysterical man to work with, but it was very exciting. We would go to lunch at Kolaboulos's, which was the one of the most wonderful restaurants at the time, with Michael McLeanMore and Hilton Edwards of the Gate Theatre in Dublin, who were very close friends of Orson's. So he would only have the four of us, and I was the only woman that he would ask to come with them. But of course he would order everything in the world that he wanted to eat. He would order for Hilton and for Michael and for me. And they would start with whatever hors d'oeuvres, what do you call it, a cordial, before you have your little soupçon of a drink. And every time, it was like the Vikings, really, at the big banquet table.
And who were you?
And every time they had one of these little jiggers of a drink, they would, one would get up and say a speech, like a Viking, you know, making his a Shakespeare or Marlowe, and even the Bible. They would do anything like that. That's why one of the things that I found was so very exciting. So I never talked. And I think that's probably why he called me the most exciting woman in the world, because I didn't talk.
You never talked?
I was like a sponge. I never talked a lot anyway. Not that I am whom I am. You guys call on me to talk a lot.
So
I talk. But not really. And therefore, I was like a sponge, and I sopped up everything I possibly could.
In that period again, we'll bring us up to the modern day in a minute, but in that period again, when you were always a kind of very sensual character on stage and in your music and in theater, and you were there at a time, the same time people like Dorothy Dandridge were around, when the model of what was sensual and sexy in America was white, blonde, and blue-eyed, that you broke through as Eartha Kitt, a siren in a sense, of the 50s and 60s. But there must have been a lot of barriers. When I look at your movies, you don't have a long list of movies where you would have played the ingenue because of who you were. I mean, how frustrating and how tough was that in that period? What kind of battles did you have over that in that period?
I really didn't think about it. I was thinking in terms of being an artist and having no color and no creed. Therefore, I was able to do a lot of things that maybe other people who would think in terms of casting you as a black person or a red person, whatever the case might be, they would cast me as the character rather than a character of color. That's one of the things that I really like about doing Cinderella, is that we have such an integrated, across-the-board nationalities. The Paolo, the prince, he is a Filipino, Chinese, or, you know, has no color. Eurasian is what we call them. And the two sisters, one is black and one is white, et cetera, et cetera. The whole cast is like that. And that's why I think I have been able to break through a lot of barriers, because I never treated myself or had making other people feel uncomfortable because I happen to be the color I am. I was told I had no color when I was a kid. I'm a yellow gal. The blacks didn't want me, and the whites didn't know what the hell to do with me. So there I was, of no race, no creed, no color, and that's why I've followed that path all my life. So the problem of being a racial thing is somebody else's. It's not mine. I am who I am, as we say in French. I'm je suis né comme ça. Il faut pas expliquer. There's nothing to explain. I am an artist. And it's the artists of the world, no matter what color we are, in the sports world, the writers, we're the ones that keep the doors of the world open. When they get into these political, governmental upheavals and religious upheavals, the politicians usually closes the doors. But if it wasn't for the sports people and the entertainers of the world, every door in the world would be closed. So I'm very glad to be in the world of entertaining.
Eartha Kitt is my guest this hour. One of the things that I read was, I said to during the break, was a very funny story that you were on location filming with Sidney Poitier in Nigeria in a movie in the 60s. And said Sidney Poitier was quoted as saying, and then she disappeared. And we didn't see her for days. Then she just walked back on the set.
Yeah. Yes, I went into the bush.
You want to tell us about going into the bush?
I went in to see what the real people were like. And I went with the daughter of the Secretary of Sanitation, who protected me, so to speak. And I lived like the people on the ground floor, on the ground, that is, and ate the food that they ate, and we lived in tents. And it was absolutely terribly wonderfully exciting. So I got to know what the real Nigerian people who live in the bush are like.
And you really, that you'd like to have that touch. I mean, one of the things that you have said about you is that you're Eartha Kitt on stage, but when you're off, you're Eartha Mae.
That's very true, because I don't think Eartha Mae has ever recognized the fact completely that Eartha Kitt is another person. So we're both separate people. We come together once in a while when we're in trouble. We have to. But I never lost that feeling of being that little urchin in South Carolina that wasn't wanted. And you talk about the story of Cinderella.
Yeah.
Cinderella really is Eartha Kitt, because when she talks about my own little corner in my own little chair, that's the way my life was with whomever I was given to by the chimney place, trying to stay warm. And wearing the rags of we call it a croquet sack. You know what that is. It's a potato sack. Mm-hmm. It's not even, it's the rough kind, like burlap. That's what I had as a dress the whole time I can remember. I never had anything that was warm and cozy.
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina.
And is it true, the stories your mother gave you away when you were 4 years old?
Well, I don't know exactly what age I was, but I certainly was old enough to remember the exact scene. And as I can, like, as I can look at her walking, it was as though she was walking into the sunset with this man, and she was on his arms. And when she left me at this particular house, I don't know how many times she had given me away before, and nobody would accept me, because they call you a yellow gal, you're not black enough, you're not white enough. And on top of that, you're an illegitimate child? My God, you know, that's really a tremendous burden to carry. But I remember standing there in the yard, watching them go off into the woods or wherever, through the fields, and the sun was shining, just about ready to go down. And it was through an arch where they had grown roses over.
Mm-hmm.
It was through that arch that I remember seeing her disappear into the wherever she was going. And they always say, the saying goes that, now there is a child that was also supposedly is my half-sister, because she was there too. And they say that when she had a daughter by this man whom she married, and then she suddenly died 6 months later, which gave us a very suspicious reason for her death. They say if a mother goes away from the child before the gods take her away, by false hands, for instance, bad hands, that she will come back to claim the youngest child. When we were at St. Peter's Church and they were burying her, I remember the scene so well. There was a huge branch from this tree going over that piece of land that she was being buried under. And they made the ritual of passing that 6 months-old child to and fro and to and fro and up and down crosswise. And that was to break the line of her coming back to claim her youngest baby, because somebody had killed her. She was murdered. And that proved to me that the stories were true.
And your half-sister?
She's in New Jersey. That is, if she is my half-sister. I don't know if she is or not. But anyway, one is in Philadelphia and the other one is in New Jersey.
And then you moved to New York with your aunt?
Yes.
And grew up
who
in Harlem.
Who says that she was my mother? So I'm very confused.
It is a confusing childhood.
Then I was living without a birth certificate until 2 years ago. And somebody from the Benedict College, as a joke, I said, I'm coming down there to do a benefit for the Benedict College in South Carolina. Wouldn't it be interesting if the students did research on Eartha Kitt? They did, and they found a birth certificate. Now again, here, Mark, the gods have already been sitting on my left shoulder. Believe me, I really do believe that. The lady who had the birth certificate in the big house or wherever you find your papers, she called me at home in Pound Ridge, and she said, we have your birth certificate. We're sure that it's yours. Do you want us to send it to you, or are you... or what? And I said, no, I'm coming down there in 2 weeks. I'll come in and get it. Now, when I went in to get the birth certificate, there was a whole line of people waiting to go in to get their papers, too, on the other side of the hall. The lady had her hands over the birth certificate, because if you're born without the father having, you know, married or something like that, they cannot tell you who your father is. unless you get a judge. And that law is on the books until this day. So I still don't know who my father is.
Because it's on the certificate.
It's no.
Oh, it's not on the certificate.
There is a name on the certificate, but everything is written in the hand of the midwife. He never signed it.
Amazing.
Whoever it is. That's why they think that I am the child of one of the cotton plantation owner's son. And that lady who was in New York, who brought me to New York, was my real mother. But because she got pregnant, she left and left me behind. Complicated, right?
That's a movie in itself.
They're doing the movie. I think they're doing it now. They're casting.
Are they?
Right.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know how they're going to tell it, but because the scripts I'm getting are not quite the ones I would like to be told. You know, they always have to bring in that sex angle and the...
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll see.
Arthur, could you mind if we take some calls here?
Okay.
I should either put the headphones under or we can get some folks to join us here. Mm-hmm. Osher in Owings Mills, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Mark. Thanks
Hi,
for taking my call. Ms. Kidd, it's a pleasure and an honor to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
New Faces of 1952 was one of my favorite shows.
Thank you.
And as a matter of fact, when I found you were coming to Baltimore, I ran out and got tickets for Cinderella.
Oh, good.
And I found a site on the internet that sells a tape for New Faces of 1952, and I bought it, and I just watched it the other night.
My goodness, they're still selling it.
Yeah.
Even I don't have a copy.
It's a little bit dated now, but it's still a lot of fun to watch.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to ask you if you could say a few words about how that show was made, how you got the role in the show, and what impact that had on your career.
Well, I was already a star in Europe, so to speak. And that brought me to the attention of the William Morris Agency, who brought me to New York for La Vie en Rose, a cabaret, a very chic la-di-da cabaret. I was not successful there because I was singing in too many languages, and therefore everybody said, what is it? Too sophisticated. Therefore, I was out of work, and I was walking around the streets of New York wondering, where's my... How do I get back to Paris? Because there I could be working all the time, no matter what, you know. So then somebody told me that Leonard Sillman was having auditions, and I went to William Morris Agency, and I said, I'd like to go down there and have an audition. They said, no, he hasn't had a hit since 1934. And I said, okay, I want to try it anyway. You know, I'm very inhibited, but when it comes to eating, then you get very gutsy, because I was starving.
You'll do anything at that point.
Right. Almost. So I went to have the audition, and I was accepted in the company. And finally, we were able to get enough money to do Faces. But, you know, that was an integrated company, too. And that's what I loved about everything in the theater. They're hired as the characters, not as a race, generally.
Right. Did that show help your career then in the United States?
Oh, yes. That made me very famous in the United States because of a song called Monotonous. And
Ike likes me.
Yeah, he remembers. But anyway, the choreographers, Bostock and her and brothers and sister, they looked at me and they said, "Arthur, what do you do?" And I said, "I can't tell you what I do. I can only show you what I do." And so they wrote this song called Monotonous. Well, I met a rather amusing fool while on my way to Istanbul. He gave me the whatever ocean for my swimming pool. Thank you, darling. My swimming pool. Monotonous. And there were like 12 verses of this four-liner. So I said, by the time I get to the other side of the stage, the whole audience is going to get up and say, yes, monotonous.
Yes.
But if you give me 6 chaise lounges... I don't think I got 6. Maybe I got 3 or 4. And I started to say monotonous across, sing monotonous across these sage lounges. And every time I came up, I would make one of these arrow, what do you call that? Gymnastical kind of movements, like a cat-like thing, you know, and say, monotonous for what it's worth throughout the earth. I'm known as Femme Fatale. And it worked, because when I got to the other side of the stage, they had to write 3 more or 4 more verses for encores.
Osher, thanks so much for that call. Glad you
joined
us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, darling. Thank you.
Well, now, where did Eartha Kitt, the cat, come from? Well, where did you begin that? How did that start with you, this notion of Eartha Kitt as the cat?
Do you know, I have no idea. The first show that I did in Paris, I remember I had, because Dunham had told me that you don't get a 2 weeks' notice, pay. You're fired right now when I gave in my 2 weeks' notice, so I thought I had 2 weeks to work it off, and then I could prepare for an opening at this cabaret to take the place of a Cuban singer. Because they had come and asked me if I would do that, because the Cuban singer had to go back to Cuba. But I had no money, and therefore, in these 2 weeks, I borrowed 35,000 francs, which was 350 francs to $1 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a piece of silk material, high heel shoes, and the only thing that I knew how to make fast by hand was like a sarong,
mm-hmm.
Darth L'Amour, that I had seen in the movie. So I stayed up all night long and I made this dress with a Christian Dior silk rose right at the hip line here.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the club and I said, the conductor said to me, "Where's your music?" I said, "I don't have any." He said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'll think of something." When I'm sitting there, I'm looking at the room, and it's a beautiful room, and I'm thinking, "What am I going to do?" So he's playing the dance music. So when he finished, he said, "Okay, have you thought of anything?" I said, "I tell you what, I know this song, that song, blah, 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 blah." And I name all the songs that I knew that would fill up for an hour. I said, "You take that out of your dance music." And that'll be my act.
And that was born.
And that's the Eartha Kitt was being born at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But now comes the time for me to go on stage, and I wouldn't go because I'm too scared. So the girls pushed me out, and instead of walking out like one would normally walk out, I walked out sideways.
Sideways?
Because now I became very ashamed of my thigh that the French love so much. And every time they came to photograph the Dunham dancers, they were always having me put my leg in the air, and that was a centerfold for their magazines. You know? So now I became very shy about my thighs and my legs. So anyway, now I get to the microphone, Mark. I was so scared, I wouldn't sing. I wouldn't say anything. I just looked at the people, and, well, you know how the French and the Latins are. They're
mm-hmm.
not very noisy talking to one another, and the knives and forks are turning all over one another. And therefore, I just stood there, and the spotlight is on me. I have no idea what I'm supposed to be saying. So finally, everybody got quiet. Now I really got scared. Now I really have to think of something. Finally, I started to talk. I don't remember what I said or how I said it, but as time went on and I became to get confidence, I started to move to the table here and move to a table there to get them to really feel that I had something to offer, whatever it was. I didn't know at the time, but that was the beginning of Eartha Kitt. And the next day the newspaper said the most exciting thing that's happened in Paris in 25 years,
and there you were born.
And there was on the affiches all over Paris. There's when I was born, yes.
You still have that sarong?
No, I don't have it. After all, Mark, that was like, what, 1950?
Let's go to the phones. John in Randallstown, you're on the air.
Hello, Miss Kitt.
Hello.
I just wanted to say that this is an honor to speak with you, and I'm a little nervous because I just think you're wonderful.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask you about a film that you made. I believe it was called Anna LaCosta.
Yes.
Yes, and I've been trying to find it on video, and I was wondering, I haven't had any success.
I
wanted to know why I can't find it, and if it's available.
Well, it must be available.
And because I've been looking, I can't seem to get, I've been to all the video stores, nobody's, in fact, I've even looked in the video books, and it's not listed.
All right, do you have a website?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Well, get somebody to find a website. You look at Eartha Kitt website.
Okay.
And my daughter will try and find it for you.
All right, fine. Thank you. I'm in love with you, all right?
Thank you. Okay. I think that website is earthakitt.com.
Yes, that
my
is your
God,
website.
My God, I've lived long enough to be a
you
com.
You have your own website. a .com.
A .com. I love it.
It's amazing how much stuff is on the web about you.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen anything.
It's all over the place. Aaron Glazer, our intern, I said, find me what you can about Eartha Kitt. He mm-hmm. just went to the web, and I just came back with reams of stuff.
Wonderful.
So you're everywhere.
Now, my birthday is going to be January 17. And on my website also talks about my organization that I have in Los Angeles, which is called Kittsville. And it's an organization that is run by the girls that I have helped since 1963 go to school, go to college and stay in school, be good neighbors and be a better for the community,
mm-hmm.
be sure you get that education and so forth and so on. So instead of sending me presents, I wish that people would send them a donation. It's Kittsville. You can find it on Eartha Kitt.
You've been doing that a long time.
.com.
.com. EarthaKit. One word, .com. But you've been doing that a long time. I mean, even the time when they brought you that to the White House, that David talked about at the very beginning of the show, when they were talking about juvenile delinquency, you've been working with kids in L.A. and other places.
Yes, all over the country. Because I still give dances, master classes in New York for underprivileged children or anybody who wants to come. But if they pay, then they have to give the money to Kitsville organization.
And what is the secret to EarthaKit being so limber and young and lovely and keep this all going? When you just a minute ago talking about your dance cross stage, you lifted your leg way above your head here in the studio. Most folks half your age couldn't lift their leg, even to their waist.
Well, Mark, to be honest with you, I kept moving and hope nobody catches me. No, that's true. You keep moving. And be sure that you get the exercise and try to eat as well as you can. Stay away from junk food. I'm not fanatical about anything because I do have my chocolate bars once in a while. But don't get fanatical and overeat, things like that. As a matter of fact, I have a book. I'm not supposed to talk about it, but Scribner's told me not to say anything about it until the time for it to come out. But it's about my feelings and how to take care of yourself and how to still be limber at the age of, as I said, 74. I'm going to be January 17.
We'll be right back with EarthaKit and herself.
You could have a great career, and you should. Only one thing stops you, dear. You're too good.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. I'm back here with EarthaKit. There are a lot of quotes I've seen of yours that have come out as I was looking at thinking about this program. And one of them was, you said once, that if the audience had never loved me, I would never have become EarthaKit.
I really do think that. I feel that. And it's so wonderful that every time I walk out on the stage, I'm scared to death. But once
still.
Yes, because you can't take anything for granted. You never know whether they like you for what you have said or something you've done. And in spite of the fact that you may be what they consider fantastic artists, you get punished for all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get the feeling from the audience that everything's okay, then I feel, okay, thank God, everything's mm-hmm. okay. And therefore, I really do appreciate my work and the feeling that I have for that public. Because I said, no matter what happened, nobody ever gave me a feeling that I was wanted, except the public.
So the what you write about in terms of Eartha Mae being very insecure and very scared in many ways when you're not on stage is very real for you.
Oh, yes, very much so, even to the point of being so scared that I can get sick on my stomach. And
mm-hmm.
God.
But you have your daughter and you have your grandchildren.
Yes, and Kit is wonderful. Now she's my manager along with the agent Bob Duva in New York, and the children are very good, and she's a very good mother. I must give her credit, and I must pat myself on the back, too, if you don't mind, Mark, because when your children turn out to be fine, particularly in our profession, you know, it's you must really feel that you're okay. And Kit is wonderful, and so are her children.
And it, well, you know, I mean, I've read about you that you, I'm a very busy woman in your work, but that when you were around your daughter, you were there.
Oh, yeah.
You were there.
And when my daughter would, when she was a baby or just walking, she would say, Mommy or Mother, and the housekeeper would run to her. I said, no. She said, Mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always there. She traveled with me until she was 15.
Is that right?
And I was so mad and so hurt because now she wanted to be home with her peers. Who the devil are those strangers?
I'm your mother.
They took my baby, my best friend, my girl away from me that I could go anywhere with, take her to museums, take her to the highest echelon of the society and even to the people who were poor because in Hong Kong, my mother-in-law, and I took my mother-in-law with me to Australia and Hong Kong when I was divorcing her son.
And she still went with you?
she and I got along great together. I think I really married her, not the son. And when I took Kit into the really poverty areas of Hong Kong, she was very much, very nervous. And I said, Mom, she's got to know everything. Whatever society we are living in or have lived in or going to be living in, she's got to know.
That's good. Let's go back to the phones. Glover, in Northeast Baltimore, you're on the air. Excuse me, I couldn't read my own writing. I apologize. Clarence, go ahead.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm good, Clarence.
Listen, I know you said not to be nervous, Mark, but I am terribly nervous. I just want to say good afternoon to Ms. Kett. I've been a fan for years. I'm a man in my 50s, and I've been a fan of hers for a long time.
Thank you.
And, your engineer answered the first question. I wasn't here originally. I just was curious as to was she born here in the States or overseas, but he told me it was in South Carolina.
Yes.
And I'm looking at, I have a magazine here, a Jet magazine from July, and I'm looking at a picture of you and your daughter.
Yes.
And you were touching on some of the things I was curious about. Did your daughter follow you into entertainment business?
And no.
Was her father an entertainer also?
No, he was nothing. He was
But
he was wonderful because he gave me the right seeds. Wrong man, right genes.
Okay.
But she's not in the business.
She didn't follow you in the business at all?
No, she's my manager now.
Oh!
Along with Mr. Bob Duva, who lives in New York as an agent.
Right.
So she's around me all the time still.
Okay, I just want to say thank you very much for taking this time.
Okay.
This was a great honor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Clarence. Now, it was reported that I wouldn't be asking these kind of questions unless it was already in the pieces have been written about you that you've written yourself, that though your real love of your life was Arthur Lowe, people say. Is that
yes,
true?
Yes, that's true.
And that he would not marry you because his family did not want him to cross racial lines.
That's right. His mother.
His mother.
Everybody in the family accepted me except his mother.
That must have been very tough.
It was, because I was doing plays in New York and he was living in Los Angeles and we were communicating on the phone. I didn't know what was going on when he was not accepting phone calls. James Dean had moved into his house because James told me that Jamie Dean was talking to me on the phone all the time at my house in New York, and he was telling me what was going on. That Lowe was very upset that his mother wouldn't accept me, and he would go into his bedroom for weeks and weeks on end with cases and cases of scotch and would not come out. So he was very unhappy. Both of us were very unhappy. Arthur Lowe's father told me that if he had known how happy his son was when we were together, that he would have forced the marriage. But he didn't find out about it until it was too late.
There are some the hills and valleys of life. You have to... I mean, there's some real lows I think people experience, as you have.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was going with Charlie Revson, too. And when he was having his problem with the, what do you call that game, $64,000.
Yeah, right. $64,000 question.
Yes.
Right.
We separated, and we were supposed to get back together, but there was a lot of fear about him losing his stockholders. So it was always that racial thing that kept us
just amazing.
Together, right?
Mary in Roland Park, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Hello, yeah.
This is Mary Harris, and I'm a friend of Denny and Earl Mowery's, and you have to really search back to Leonard Stillman. New Faces, when
52.
You were on the stage with Denny Mowery, and she was the understudy.
Oh, my goodness, yes, I remember now.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Well, they live in Texas, and they always cherished your memory, and at the time, you all were quite good friends. At least you were friendly.
Yes.
And they live together in Texas, and I can't wait to tell them that I'm going to see you tonight in Cinderella.
Okay, well, please give them my regards, because I do remember them very well.
They were wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
They acted and produced and went on not to be famous like you, but they have had a wonderful life in theater that mm-hmm. was a small theater.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you tonight.
All right, thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mary. Kevin in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Miss Kitt. It's Kevin Brown calling.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about any special diet that you have. You look wonderful.
Hi.
I saw you at the Cafe Carlisle last year, and you looked absolutely fabulous.
Yes.
Is there anything that you exercise or eat to make
Read
you look so fabulous?
The book.
It's not out yet, though.
Not out yet. It'll be out in May.
we'll have
so
less.
No, it'll be answering your question. Excuse me, Mark.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We'll ask Ms. Kitt to come back in May. She can reveal those things when her book comes out.
Okay. It'll be fun
for
me.
Thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome,
Take
Mary.
Care, Kevin. Kevin in Baltimore. Another Kevin. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Kevin.
Mark, this is Kevin, formerly of the Baltimore Sun. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Great. Eartha,
yes.
Love you to death.
Thank
Saw you.
Saw you
at the Carlisle last year.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you're going to be back at the Carlisle this year. And my second question is, why have we not seen more of you on the silver screen, and might we in the near future?
I don't know why I haven't been doing more films, because I don't like to do films that have to do with any particular whatever, you know, because I'm not... What is that?
I think his car was blowing up in front of us.
Oh. No,
it was his digital phone, I think, was dying.
Right. Well, and they haven't been writing the kind of stories that I really have fallen in love with. I wanted to do Marie Laveau. It's about a voodoo priestess of New Orleans who happens to be mulatta and who was a hairdresser. And she mixed Catholicism with voodoo and got a lot of wonderful things done for the people of New Orleans. But they say it's not ready for the American public to accept.
Why would they say something like that?
Because it was a black woman who was running the whole society of New Orleans at that time. And she was the one that saw to it that anybody who had interracial children, those children out of that contact would have to go to Europe, be highly educated. And these mulattas, the octoroons, were the real high-class society of New Orleans.
The Creoles
in the 1900s.
And that would be a marvelous movie.
But you see, nobody wants to do it yet, because I don't understand how they think that the American people are the way they think the American people are. They don't give the American people the credit to be intelligent enough to be able to say, yes, I like the story, or give them at least the chance to say whatever their feelings are. But just not to take the chance at all, I think that's quite wrong. But we might be able to do it for the theater, because I think the theater is much more free in that kind of thinking.
But I think the story of Marie Laveau would be an incredible thing to have on screen.
Mm. It would be, I think. Tremendous musical. And it's part patois. It's French and English.
And you speak French.
Yes.
Evelyn in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, Miss Kit.
Hello.
I'm also 72, and I just want to compliment you on your humor and your approach to your problems.
Thank you.
And it's, I've never appreciated that before in you.
Mm.
But it's been a pleasure to hear you talk about your life.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone.
Yeah, my life has been quite wonderful. It has not been boring.
That's sure.
And whether I had my ups or my downs or my in-betweens, it was still wonderful, because now I had to really think about how am I going to get myself out of this predicament, or do I just take it and let it phase itself out? 99 and 9/10 of a town. When you're worrying about something to such an extent, the worry doesn't help anything.
Right.
You just have to wait it out.
It's hard not to
while
worry
you're
sometimes.
Constructively trying to do something about it, of course.
So now, what are your dreams now about what you'd like to do? You mentioned Marie Laveau. I mean, what kinds of things are you thinking about that you'd like to tackle? Where does Earthykit take her career now?
Probably more legitimate theater. And I like doing characters that have no race, creed, or color, because now I like funny characters, you know, like the character I'm doing now. And you cannot identify her as belonging to anything, because I've always said I belong to everybody because they have made me whom I am. So I don't have anything to think in terms of as far as going anywhere except legitimate theater. And I will be doing more books, too, because I've been asked all the time to write books, write what my feeling about philosophy is. And that's one of the reasons why Scribner's has accepted this particular book, because even though it talks about exercise, it talks about it a little bit. But I have not been fanatical about anything except to keep my mind busy, occupied, and my body as well as I can physically fit.
Now, who are your... You said philosophers. I'm curious, who are your favorite philosophers? Who do you like to read?
Plato. And I love the Oriental philosophy. The wisdoms of China, the wisdoms of Lao Tzu, for instance. What absolutely inextricably interesting. That's why I think we Westerners are going to have a hard time with China, because China is not in a hurry to go anywhere. She is like a snail, and she will be taking over when you least suspect. And I can see that, and I feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what this government says about making friends with China, you can make a friend, but I'll watch your back.
See, one of the things that's so interesting about you and what I've read is that you may be a singer and a dancer and an actress and done all these things like that, but you also have a real intellectual curiosity in terms of what you read and think about, the quotes that I've seen of you about poverty, about race, about being gay in America, not you're gay in America, mm-hmm. but being gay in America. I mean, it's somebody who sits and not doesn't just act, but thinks a great deal about the world that's around her.
Well, I think it's wonderful that we have television today, because we can get an education at home if we were interested enough to look at shows like C-SPAN, History, Discovery. And the school, the university programs goes on at 6 o'clock in the morning. I said, what did they do that for? While I'm putting my clothes on or getting ready to go for my jogging, I'm getting an education from some kind of university. And there are always these kind of things on television if you're not interested in picking up a book to be read. I'm reading now Goethe's book on the betrayal
mm-hmm.
and the China threat. Those books should be in everybody's library.
Now, you also, out of time almost. I was going to ask another 10 questions. There's only time for maybe a half a question. But you're about to do a voiceover. Your voice coming out on some animation for Disney now?
What's yes, the film is out. It was out. I think it started 2 days ago. The Emperor's New Groove.
The Emperor's New Groove.
That's right. And she plays the part of Yzma, who wants the throne. She doesn't want to kill anybody. She just want to knock him off the throne so she can take over. Sounds like somebody else I know, but anyway, I'm going to do that.
And on that note, Eartha Kitt, it's been a true pleasure to have you in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in and joining
okay.
us. Thank you.
All right, Mark.
Eartha Kitt was with us this hour, and enjoy her as Cinderella. Not as Cinderella, but you are the evil...
She's not really evil. She's just naughty.
The naughty.
Fairy thing. Godmother. Yeah.
We should all be so lucky. Thank you. Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our intern is Michael Dixon. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews of Clean Cuts. Now send me your thoughts about today's program too, to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of Mark Steiner Show and share with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend. Take care.